Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. And today I'm joined with Juliana. Say hello.
Hello everyone.
Normally you join me on a book where we've read the book together. This one, you've not read this book, but you wanted to join in with the podcast anyway.
Yeah, just because I've read one book of the series.
So you thought you could contribute. Now, the book series that we're talking about is the Broken Earth series by N.K. Jemisin. And this book, the last book in the trilogy, The Stone Sky. And it's, again, it's always one of those tricky things to talk about a book, which is the last in a series or the second in a series, because it really depends on people already reading the first two books, or especially the second book, to actually understand what the story is going along. It's sort of like, okay, your task is to review a Return of the Jedi, start off, sum up the story from the start. You're like, no, because you've really got to go all the way back to the start of the first movie, or the, you know, whatever,
yeah,
like two installments of the story beforehand to get people really up to speed. And then also you don't want to say, oh yeah, it turns out that Darth Vader is Luke's father, and you don't want to go into those details, because then you're spoiling it, you know. So it's like getting people up to speed without spoiling the first two books is really, really tricky. However, the first book does start with saying there's these things called seasons, fifth seasons, and the fifth seasons are the time where where there's a big earthquake and it spews loads of ash into the sky or whatever, and volcanoes spew ash, and it kind of, you know, like an extinction event in our past, or like a meteor hitting would be an extinction event. These fifth seasons are kind of like almost extinction level events where humanity has to band together into the communities, and you know, they put up the walls and block everyone else out. And those are the fifth seasons. Those are the seasons that they have to get through. Humanity has to get through every generation or so. Otherwise, the world is just going to keep, just keep going on like that. And,
yeah,
and one of the questions is, where do these come from? Why are they there? And how do people survive them? And the first book actually starts off by saying, this is the story of the end of the Broken Earth. It's the last fifth season or whatever.
Okay.
You know.
So it doesn't start at the beginning.
Well, it says, right, I am now telling this story, and this is the story of the last fifth season. And there's two ways to read that. And one way to read it is that, no, literally, this is the end of the world. And after this, there's not going to be any humans left to tell any more stories about it.
Okay.
And you're thinking, could be the last people to be around?
Was it known that right from the beginning this was going to be a trilogy, or was this
here's
a book? And,
No, it definitely wasn't the full story, because there's so many unanswered questions. So there's the other unanswered question. So one of the unanswered questions is, like, you know, in all these fantasy stories, okay, where did these obelisks, you remember these obelisks floating around, and they have things
and
inside and whatever like that, where do they come from? What's
they
all that about?
From it?
Yeah, there's a harbour, there's an obelisk underneath a harbour in the first book, and the second book's called The Obelisk Gate. And actually right at the start of the first book, they actually say, hey, there's these things floating around in the sky called obelisks, but they're not important, that's not going to come up any at all later on in the book. And I was like, okay, make a note of that, so that's going to be important. And they are important all the way through. So there's these big questions. Oh, and also you get the origins, and those are the people who have magic that can control earthquakes, or if an earthquake happens, they can still the earthquakes. They have rock tectonic movement magic powers.
But also it's attached to their emotions, like if they get like angry and stuff, like they are so attached to the ground that their anger
they kind of pull energy out of the earth, and it turns everything cold, or they pull energy out of the atmosphere and everything goes cold, and they redirect their energy in there. So there's lots of like entropy kind of things tied to people's emotions.
Pretty cool idea.
Yeah, there's lots of really great stuff in that first book. The second book, I thought there was lots of interesting stuff in it, but it kind of, like, the thing that I really enjoyed about the first book, anyway, I don't want to get too much into this, but the idea is, like, okay, we need these answers, like, where do the origins come from, where do the obelisks come from, why are there fifth seasons, why is this? And guess what happens in the third book?
They find out?
Yeah, well, they don't find out, but we find out.
Oh.
Us story people find out about that, which is a bit weird, because there was actually some people in the story who knew that already, going all the way back, that knowledge was there, but they just decided not to share that knowledge until the fifth book. And also, that knowledge doesn't really help anybody in the story conclude the story. You know,
the fifth book. What's the fifth book?
Oh, sorry, the third book. End of the trilogy. Okay. So this is the thing. Like, if you actually told this story in chronological order, it wouldn't make any impact. The knowledge that you know as a reader would not be a spoiler.
Okay.
Like, if you knew what happened back in the day, or put it this way, if our main character, Nessun, if she knew what happened back in the day, at the very beginning of the book, it probably wouldn't have impacted the story at all, because she still needed to do what she needed to do in books 2 and 3 to do what she needed to do at the end of the book, and her daughter, who turns up in the... that's Nessun. Her daughter is Nessun. She's Essen and Nessun, or something like that. It's a little bit confusing. As you can tell, I'm already confused. But that's the thing. It's sort of like, I don't like books where, like, one of the main reveals or the main backstory... The characters in the book, some characters in the book already know that, but they've just decided not to tell that story, or not just to fill that story in for the people. But then it wasn't even needed anyway. And unfortunately, the backstory of what happened in the past isn't all that satisfying, either from a character motivation point of view. Like, why is the world the way that it is? It just turns out some people were angry and destroyed stuff. And I totally get that people get angry and just destroy stuff, but it felt a bit weak, because I kind of felt we'd already had that story in the first book and in the second book. The reason why Alabaster was like, okay, we've got to do this crazy thing, is because, you know, you want to shake up the system, you know, push back against the despotic, all that kind of stuff going on. Yawn away from the microphone, that's good. But it's kind of just that played out again, and I understand it. I understand the feeling behind it, but it wasn't really sold across, because I hadn't spent a whole novel spending time learning about, you know, how they were brought up and things like that. Yeah. We just get a few glimpses back to, okay, and now 65,000 years ago, I haven't fired it back, it is, this character was this, like this, and they did this, and, you know, when we get filled in with that technology, I'm trying to do it as little spoilers as possible, but in the end it's sort of like, yeah, but that's what we've just been through with these other characters, and then so why is this happening anyway? It wasn't that satisfying.
Like in the first book, what I really liked in the first book was also the way that the story was told, the timeline of the story, how it goes. Like, you read through it and you have little knowledge when is what.
Yes.
And then,
well, there's three
different
characters in three different timelines,
and then they kind of tell from different kind of time looking and into the thing. And does that continue in the series? And third book?
The problem is that that doesn't happen. And this comes down to what we're talking about, the Raven stratagem by Yun-Ha Lee, following up with Nine Fox Gambit and other books, where you go, all the stuff that I really enjoyed about the first book in the series, that was kind of played out, and they couldn't do more of that because it's a trick. It relies on a twist of storytelling or a concept of storytelling that you can't keep... You could keep it going, but the author was like, oh no, we've got to do something new in the second book. Unfortunately, these authors haven't done something new in the second and third books of the series. They've just, all the stuff that I enjoyed about the first book, storytelling-wise and concept-wise and ideas-wise, none of that's in the second book. It comes back a little bit in the third book, but in all three books, there's this character who you knew their name back then, and now they have another name here, but you're not meant to know that the same character. Oh, it turns out they're the same character. That does happen in all three books, but it was never a surprise to me, but I enjoyed the storytelling process that you could do with that in the first book. It was felt new. Sure. And also, there was a bit of levity, because in the first book you had these different storylines. You had, like, the child going to magic school. You got the Harry Potter learning how the magic works, you know, finding her place and the thing. Then you get the character who is sort of like more grown up. I think she's 18, 19, 20 or something.
Yeah.
And she goes off on an adventure with Alabaster, and there's some interesting...
It's like an apprenticeship.
Yeah, it's an apprenticeship thing. But you still get like, she's discovering how powerful she is. How many rings does she wear? Because if you're a one ring or two ring or five ring, and she's going out with a 10 ring person who earns the rings of how powerful they are at this stone moving magic. She's got a job to do, and then she goes on an adventure, and then she meets some sexy pirates, and there's a sexy pirate pirate adventure kind
totally
of thing.
I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, it's in there. It's there in the
no
book.
No idea about that.
But you remember, Rich, the ships come along and she spears the ships with the rocks and stuff like that. And you don't remember any of that?
No.
And she has a son by the people? No?
No,
okay.
Don't recall it at
all. There is a sexy pirate adventure going on.
Sure.
And at the time I was like, oh, fucking hell, what is it about these things? There's another series called the Gentleman Bastard series, which by I think it's Scott Lynch or something. The first one is The Lies of Loch Lamora, and then The Red Sea Under Red Skies. And it's a similar kind of thing where there's magic-y people and there's lots of precursor technology. And also in that book, there's sort of like a random sexy pirate adventure as well. And it's like sideways from the plot, like adjacent to the plot. It's sort of like, oh, shit, what do we need? Sexy pirate adventure story. So they go off and do that and then come back and they're like, well, I had my sexy pirate adventure story. And it's kind of interesting because if you have the sexy pirate adventure story, it can be sideways because they're outside of the law. They're outside of society.
Yeah,
you can go off and have full adventures over there and you can come back and none of that means anything because they're outside society, outside the law, and it's disconnected from the world.
You can pretty much do anything with it.
You can do anything that you want.
Yeah.
And it can be as sexy as you want and as adventurous as you want. And it's funny in both of these books. I was like, oh, for goodness sake, what's this? We could have, that story would have spent, that would have made just as much sense if you hadn't have had that sexy pirate adventure. And
I
tell you something, by the time you get to halfway through book two, and especially halfway through book three, I was longing for a sexy pirate adventure. Because the thing in the third book, which is actually kind of like the most meaningful part, although not meaningful part, but the most emotionally impactful part, is the stuff that happens in the fifth season. In this season, and she's going off, and she's having, you know, she comes home and her son has been beaten to death by the father. This is what kicks off this story, isn't it?
That's the beginning of the book.
It's the beginning of that timeline.
Yeah.
Son being beaten to death by the father for being a secret rock magic user.
Yeah.
Abducted the daughter and run off. And then she gets home and finds that. Then there's this massive cataclysm that she does. She kills everyone in her own village and leaves. And you're just like, wow, that's pretty grim. And then it doesn't get less grim. It keeps on with that grimness.
Yeah, that was kind of heavy.
But at the same time, you've got Harry Potter and a child learning magic and sexy pirate adventures.
It always kind of like...
Yeah, put these things together. Yeah, yeah. Okay, second book. Forget the sexy pirate adventure side story quest learning apprentice stuff. And there is a little bit with her daughter, who is, you know, Harry Potter learning magic when you're young and finding your way in the world and what your powers are and things. There's a bit of that, but all of that's still happening in this fifth season. You know, all is this happening in this this post-apocalyptic/post-apocalyptic landscape. And it's all like that. And then
so
the third book, it just continues on like that. And it's sort of like, oh, we've got this community, and they have, at the end of the second book, they're like, okay, we've got to leave. And okay, we're leaving. And then she wakes up in a coma and she's being dragged along. And then a lot of this book, this was like a 14-hour audio, but actually I brought up the Audible thing here. Yeah. So 14 hours and 16-minute audio book. And I'm not kidding, the first around about 10 to 11 hours is just a slog. Now, I understand that these slog stories where, okay, we've got these people, they've got to get through a desert, and a lot of them are going to die. You know, I've read that in fantasy books before. There's this book that I'm reading now, Malazan, Book of the Fallen. The second book in there, there's this, okay, this army has got to go from here across there, like all the way across the continent, and a lot of people don't make it. And I find that, and the same happens in the... in another fantasy book, the Prince of Nothing series, it's about, okay, this army has to go through
you kind of like put the characters through some very heavy time.
Really heavy.
And at some point you have like a relief or...
Yes, yeah, there's small victories on the way, but it's very much sort of like, okay, Napoleon, you've seen the infographic of Napoleon going into Russia, and it starts off with 400,000 people, and on the way back out, like 11,000 people make it back out, like back across into France or back into Germany, wherever they were.
Sure.
And you see that thing and go, oh shit, that was 500,000 people died on that journey, and 20,000 people came out of it at the other end.
Yeah.
And if you tell that story of those 20,000 people that came out of it at the other end, you're like, oh, that's that's grim. That's hardcore. You know, there's a lot of stuff that they have to get through to get out of the other end, and it changes them as people.
You kind of attach the audience, like you kind of make them understand more the suffering.
And it's interesting to read that in fiction. The problem is in this book is that it never gets that grim. I mean, it starts off and you think, okay, there's 1,000 people, and they're like, right, we're going to go through this desert. Not everyone's going to survive. So you think, okay, going in 1,000 people, I was expecting maybe 200 to get out of the other end. It's like, oh no, like 850 people got out the other end. And I was like, but that's not grim enough. Like, that it could have been a lot worse. Like, and you're thinking, well, that's a triumph, but then it wasn't good enough. And then we read after it, there's a character who was helping out. It's sort of like, oh, this person, well, I was actually the one who went over there, and there was some food there, and I was the one who went over and ruffled this thing and let people discover this cache of food along the way. And I was like, there's been a guardian angel. Oh, and you abandoned that person. And then I went back and I actually comforted her until she died because, you know, you abandoned her because she couldn't walk anymore. Mm. And she was just like, no, that's it. You guys go on ahead. Mm. And it could have been all this emotional thing. And then it's sort of like, oh no, I actually made it a lot better than it could have been. So it's sort of like, oh, so it's like this double switch. And even at that point, it actually goes, oh, we went in there and it's going to be really bad. You're going to find it really bad. So let's just now skip forward until the end of the journey and just do a summing up of the death toll along the way. And so I didn't even get that. But it took a really long time to get there. And it took a long time to get through there. And then even all of the slog, which I enjoy reading stories about a slog, the great slog, you know, go on a march. Like,
what does slog mean?
A slog just means something that's really difficult to get through. That's real slog. This podcast is a real slog for some people, you know, you've not read Lord of the Rings or seen it, have you? Anyway, there's classic passages of there where like, okay, this entire half of this book is going to be these three characters trying to get from this side of the swamp to the other side of the swamp. Right. Are you ready for this? This is going to be half of this book. Let's go. And you're like, that's going to be quite a slog. And it's like, yeah, it is quite a slog, but it's a classic fantasy trope to get a group of characters.
You make the reader suffer as much as the people. Yes,
and it is part of it. It's not making you take people on that journey. Like, you take the reader on that journey. And unfortunately, this book tries to do that, but then doesn't. But it's
so
still
it doesn't go far enough.
No, it's still a slog to read, but where the slog of the journey is just, again, the writing is great, the characters are great, but I'm just saying story-wise, it doesn't do anything. So, like, I was listening to this audiobook, and it was just grim and not very interesting story-wise. And I was like, what are these people doing? Also, and here's the real key thing, some characters can travel through rock. You know, there were stone eaters in the first book.
Stone eaters,
and they can carry humans through the rock. So at one point, she's like, "I want to find my daughter," and a stone eater picks her up and goes, "It'll only take us a minute." And then 2 minutes later, she's through like half a continent away, and they're like, "Oh, is your daughter here?" No, but there's some other thing. They meet some other people. We don't know where your daughter is, and so. While this slog is going on, she's like, oh, at any time, I could just be whisked away by my stone eater guardian angel, and the guardian angel will just take me where I want to go, so there's not really any danger for me. And they can take other people away. Yeah, it's one of these things that I like to say that's very convenient. It's all like, oh, there's some magic that you need. Oh, conveniently, you open the spell book at the page that you need to do this thing. You know, it just happens to open. I mean, that's not what we have.
You just conveniently find it.
Yeah.
Which has the right things in it.
There's another character who needs to get somewhere. And in the first book, you have these guardians. And it turns out these guardians... You remember the guardians? Yeah. The one who broke the hand and stuff like that. So there's a guardian in this book as well. There's guardians all the way through. But the guardian in this book is like, right, we need to get somewhere. It turns out if we go into this ruin and then turn left and go down here, press this secret thing, we open up the precursor technology. They had a monorail system.
What's precursor?
Oh, precursor is like the so in ancient Egypt, there was like, what are these pyramids doing here? It's sort of like a precursor civilization. So the people living there live in the shadow of the technology of like the past civilization, but it's not their civilization.
Oh, okay.
So there's been a dark age, and then they come back. You know, people going down into Rome and going, how does this concrete work? They built the Colosseum and they built the Parthenon, and their concrete technology has been lost to time. That kind of precursor. And in science fiction and fantasy, it's often like precursor technology is sort of like there used to be science fiction back in the day, but now it's just magic, or now it's all fallen. And
right.
You understand that.
So it's like a society that got lost.
Yeah. Did you read the Jack Vance series, The Dying Earth?
I read the first book.
Yeah, the first book. There's lots of precursor technology in there. Ah. You know, like, this city is a science fiction city with flying cars and stuff. But nobody knows how the technology works anymore. Right. But the people just live among the ruins of it
they
and stuff
like
that.
They just enjoy it.
So, it turns out, all this time, there's been a precursor technology monorail system just under the ground. And they can just take the train across to the other continent that they need to get to. And I was just like, but why isn't... Why are people... You can't set up a slog through a desert where... You know, most of the people are going to die, but then most of the people don't die. With Guardian Angels, with transporter technology, and also the Guardians have the transporter technology, but then you have like the Guardian Angel, the Stone Eater people, who can transport people through rock and get them out of scrapes whenever they need to anyway. And all the time, I'm just like, but always the tension and the drama in the book in terms of post-apocalyptic stuff was being undercut by the story, being told itself.
Okay.
Which isn't to say the characters aren't interesting. I enjoyed spending time with the characters, and what they go through could be interesting, but again, it's being undercut all the time. And then, unfortunately, what we read about, you know, when I'm saying we find out about the backstory and that the motivations are all not great. Also, when we find out about the precursor technology and how it works, that's not very satisfying either, because it starts off and you're like, oh, what are these obelisks? It's some ancient technology. Well, what's going on there? You can either, and this is probably the best way to do it, not explain all of that, or explain it in such a wishy-washy term, that it's just, you know, unexplainable, unexplainatomium, and
it's just,
hand-wavium, just and it just works like that. And it's just there, which is great. Perfectly fine with that, but here they're like, oh no, we've got to talk about this, and then it gets into really detailed explanations, like minutiae of how the obelisks work, how many obelisks, this many obelisks were doing this thing, this obelisk was a powerful obelisk, and it keeps going in there, and what is powering those things? Well, this is being powered by these things here, and this is being powered by this thing, and then where's this thing? Well, the moon is missing. They said at the end, oh, well, the moon is going here. What's happening to the moon? The moon's coming back. What happened to the moon? Well, they went to the moon, and this happened, and that happened on the moon, and all this time I was just like, it's overly technical. But at the base of all this technical stuff, you go, well, what's powering all of this? Is it nuclear fission, or is it what's going on? Are they tapping into the culture is sort of like the layers of different expanding universes, the energy grid, all of that kind of stuff. But in the end, at the base of all of it, it's just sort of like, oh, it's just magic. And I'm like, don't talk to me about all the technical stuff about this and how this works. And in the end, just going all the way down at the bottom of this, oh, it's just magic. Now, one thing I did like about that kind of thing is that, you know, when it says, oh, the Earth is angry, the world is angry, and they're always talking about Father Earth is angry at the humans. Maybe not so much in the first book. In the second book, there's a lot more about that. It turns out, in this fantasy world, the Earth is kind of sentient and does have opinions and does have emotions, and you can communicate with it.
Oh, nice.
That's kind of like written away, and like in the last two chapters of the book, I'm just like, this entire time the Earth was sentient, and when they're saying the Earth is angry, it's like, yeah, the Earth was angry, like it really was angry, and I was just like, but this should be what the book is, like, how could this not be what the book is about? Some characters have known this, like the Stone Eaters, you know, they're immortal Stone Eaters.
Of course, they're close to the Earth.
Yeah, they've been around for ages, and that's where they are. Anyway, I have other story issues that I don't even need to go into, because it feels like I'm piling on this book a lot. But it just doesn't hold together. Like, there's so much promise in that first book. Again, that first book, I think I gave it 4 stars.
Yeah.
Really solid. The second book was a slog, and the story wasn't that satisfying. I was like, but if the third book wraps this up, if the third book pulls this off, it's going to, you know, it's going to bring that book up, you know, that second book up, which is always difficult to do.
It's going to bring the whole thing
The average is all going to be good, and if it pulls it off, this is going to be like a 4-star series. Unfortunately, literally the first 10 hours of this 14-hour audiobook, it could literally be summed up, these characters are back here and they've gone here, like the summary of like what that slog was. Just read that, and then there's the backstory part of what happened, you know, at the original breaking of the Earth, where we get like the 65,000 years ago backstory, or however long ago it was, that kind of thing. Yeah, and just you could just read those. But those are actually too little of the book. They're just very small chapters being dropped in. And I could have done with a lot more of that.
Yeah.
If it had just been like, okay, let's just do a whole novella just of that backstory, kicked it off. Okay, and now let's have the last four chapters of this. Mm. Great. It could have been done that because the characters weren't moving on. There's nothing really that happened to Nessun at the start of this book which made what she did at the end of the book more interesting or better. I mean, it does explain her choices, but it doesn't really. And then the character motivations of Nessun. No, that's Essen. And then Nessun, her daughter. Sorry, I'm getting mixed up now. It's just like she doesn't go through anything in this book which brings her on any further from the previous book.
Yeah.
Like, I never thought in the previous book, I mean, I didn't enjoy it massively, but there was never a moment where I thought, oh yeah, all of that story that we went through just wasn't worth it. But the first 10 hours of this 14-hour audiobook, except for the, you know, deep backstory part, 10 hours of it was just like, that just wasn't worth it. You know, except for those backstory chapters, it just didn't feel worth it. Even though, again, it's very well written and the characters are interesting to spend time with and the things that happen along the way, some of them are mildly interesting from a story point of view. There just wasn't enough story to go round in these second two books. And that's a real pity because there was so much story in that first book.
Oh, yeah.
It was all story. There was three main stories. Each one of them could be a novel.
Yeah.
But the second two books between them have got barely one novel's worth of story, and it's spread over two 14-hour audiobooks, and it just doesn't hold together. So, it's a real pity. Again, let's now have a look over here at.
I already saw at the Audible audiobooks, yeah. Like,
Stone Sky.
Story
yeah.
has 2 out of 5 stars.
No, for me. No, that's mine.
Oh, that's yours. No.
Average is 4.6 out of after 418 ratings for the audiobook. Audiobook's pretty good. Robin Miles did, I think, all of the audiobooks. Yeah, so it's kind of nice to stick with one narrator through a whole series like that. But here we go. Over on Goodreads, 4.5 after 3,311 ratings. That's really high. The first book won the Hugo Award. The second book won the Hugo Award, and now the Stone Sky. I think it's a shoo-in, and people are just going to give it the Hugo Award, just say, hey, the whole series, every book won the Hugo Award, and it'll be the first time that's happened, probably.
Okay.
You know, the first two, Ender's Game and Speaker for the Dead, both won the Hugula. They both won Nebula and Hugula the time that it published. But that's not a series in a way that it's sort of like first book in a series, first book in a trilogy, second book in a trilogy, third book in a trilogy. That was a standalone story. And then the second book is pretty much another standalone story.
Yeah.
And it's understandable. There's a writer who wrote a first book and then was like, I'm going to do something completely different in the second book, but there's enough interesting stuff happening in the second book that I don't feel shortchanged about not having the good stuff that was in the first book.
Yeah.
You know, all the clever stuff that was going on and the twists and the story and the young person at Wizard Camp. Well, no, it's not Wizard, it's Battle School or whatever it is. You know, all of that, none of that, literally none of that at all was in that second novel.
Okay.
Is in Speaker for the Dead. None of it. It's sort of like, oh, now this kid that you're around with when he was, you know, when he was like 10 or 11 or however old he is going through Battle School. And the second book is like, right, now he's about 40 and he's traveling around the world, you know, as a kind of modern day priest, speaking at people's funerals or not speaking, but like speaking for the dead. And it's just a completely different thing. And you're like, oh, nothing in this book was in the first book. So I don't feel shortchanged about the stuff that I enjoyed about the first book not being there.
Yeah.
It's just so different that you're just like, great. It's the same, different to this book, where like there's so much of the first book in the second book, except all the interesting storytelling and the different characters and the pirate sex adventures.
Yeah.
It's the same with the follow up to Fire Upon the Deep, the immediately sequel to that. It's sort of like what you really enjoyed about the first book is the dogs, which were like they were shared minds and all this weird stuff. And then in the second book, well,
we
don't get any of that. Well, actually, in the follow up book, which is The Deepness in the Sky, which have you read that one yet?
No, I haven't read any of the
Deepness in the Sky is like, okay, it's set in the same world, but this time we're having spiders, we're having this spaceship stuck in space. It's a totally different setup with only one character in common, but it's in the same world. But there, I wasn't thinking, oh, the stuff that I really enjoyed in the first book, which was this interesting aliens, now those interesting aliens are in the second book, but they're minor background characters, so what? It's sort of like we're gonna have new interesting aliens but completely different in different ways, you know.
So
That's so it's
another way
the,
of doing it.
Another way of doing it. And here, there just isn't. I don't know. It's impressive the high rating this book has got.
Is this part of this as well? The Stone Hunger. Is
Stone
that
Hunger.
One?
I don't know what they published into. No, I think that's sort of like a short story. What does it say? Yeah, 17 pages. So it's just a short story or something like that. Probably set in the same world.
Yeah, sounds a bit like it.
Yeah. Because I think actually the first book was inspired by a short story. Or no, like you wrote a short story which was well received. What am I looking for? We've got half an hour on this book. Shall I?
Did you do all the notes that you have?
I will have a look at the notes because we did all this thing. Oh yeah, Nesson and Schaffer noodling around for 90% in the book. Nesson seems a bit too old to be just 10 or 11 years old at the end. Why does she want the world to end? Oh yeah, Schaffer is one of the best characters. Do you remember Schaffer in the first book? He was the guardian.
Yeah.
And I really liked him. And then he's lost his memory. Like, aww. He comes back and he's lost his memory. And then he's not the same character anymore. And I'm like, I really enjoyed this character. Don't
now
bring a character back. Again, you're bringing a character back who's lost their memories and doesn't remember who they were. And it's like, stop putting this character who was really interesting and really liked in this book, but then not being the cool character they were in the first book. Again, his story is actually more interesting. You know, there is more stuff going on there, but it's like Essen and Tonki noodling around for 80% of the book. Yeah, Kastrima. Lots of people die trying to cross a desert. Could have been good, but then skips forward and then magics away the hardship or something. Kastrima, I don't know why I should care about these people in this thing. The one person I do care about, who is Essen, the main character, it's then you're just like, that character,
you know that she won't,
she's gonna be fine because
she's
gonna get through it, and she's got a guardian, she's got a guardian stone angel. Hoa and his still anarchist backstory. And it's sort of like, oh, they wanted to destroy the Earth, so it has to be really bad for them to destroy the Earth. I'm like, yeah, but we had this in the foot. You know, we read this with Alabaster's story and him wanting to... Anyway, whatever. Obelisk Gate Minutia, technology-based magic. The Earth is really sentient. I thought that was just a metaphor. So, yeah, and also the whole idea is, here's my block capitals notes. Why are we spending so much time getting places when we can just fly? And in this book, it isn't normally fly. They're not actually flying.
Sure.
You know, stone eaters can carry people through the center of the Earth, but there's also Willy Wonka glass elevators, you know? And I was just like, which isn't glass. But it's sort of like, yeah, but if we do this... And they're going through this passage in the Earth, and I thought the whole Earth was, like, unstable. Like, how are they doing these... How are these passages through the Earth still there when it's being racked with... Yeah, it is. And it's just sort of like there's these tendrils of white stuff and stuff like that. Book 3, also dreary, had me wishing for sexy pirate sex adventures. So there were all my notes. So I guess I did get through all of my notes. It's really disappointing. So let's have a look here on Goodreads. 4.51 on average.
Yeah.
And 4.58.
Your friends have 4.58.
Lindsay rated it 5 stars. Tudor rated 5 stars. Mikkel, 4 stars. Margaret, 4 stars. Noel, Romy, 5 stars. So lots of people are really enjoying these books. You know, so many answers to mysteries I didn't even know I had. You know, I didn't need that many answers. The answers were unsatisfying.
Okay.
And they were kind of overly explained in some ways, but then not enough spent on them in the other ways. I'm just like, wait... The Earth, it's not a metaphor that the Earth is angry. It
I want to
really
know more
is.
About
yeah.
this.
So I'm like, how can this be, like, only mentioned? And at the end, like, those last few chapters of backstory and actually what's happening at the end, there's a lot of stuff. There's just lots of details in there. Like, oh, and this is the answer to that one. This is the answer to this one. This is the answer. And I'm like,
have been spread over the book.
Yeah. I was, like, hanging out for 10 hours of this audiobook waiting to find out these answers. Or, in fact, the whole second book. These coming through here. And at one point, they go to the moon, and then they're like, oh, and then the moon was flung off into space. Mild spoilers, but, you know, at the end of the first book, they're like, oh, there's a moon, it's coming back. And it's sort of like, oh, why was the moon going so far away? What flung the moon off into space or something like that? And then the moon's going to come back. And I was just like, so you were on the moon, and then the moon got flung into space, and then you went to sleep, and you woke up, and you were back on Earth.
Was it a dream?
No, it actually happened. And then I'm like, how did you get back to Earth? And it's sort of like, and then I woke up and I was back on Earth. And I don't know how I got back on Earth. And it was never explained how I got back on Earth. But here I am. And I'm like, so at the depth, at the root of all of these of all of these mysteries of like how does the magic work, all this kind of stuff, and you get all the way through these minutiae and technical details, and the base of all the technical details is like, oh, it's magic, you know, who can really explain, and the earth is sentient, and I'm like, ah. Anyway, so lots of people, everybody rated it 5 stars. I'm going to rate it like 2.5 stars or 2 stars. Well, it's difficult, really. It's just in the end.
I mean, you have to rate it so it's your enjoyment of the book.
10 hours out of a 14-hour audiobook. I was like, I'm only reading through to the end of this to kind of get the full, you know, to finish off this series.
Sure.
And I don't feel like I want to read fiction out of obligation of having finished off the series.
I know how that feels.
Same kind of things happen now with the with another book that I was saying. There's this R. Scott Baker, really good fantasy story in this first trilogy. First book, great. Second book, great. Third book, in the trilogy, really not great. But then you're at the end of the trilogy. Unfortunately, the second series is 4 books long. First book, great. Second book, great. Third book, really not great. And now there's a fourth book, and I'm like, if that third book was just a disappointing end to a trilogy like the first one was, that'd be great. And now I'm like, oh, I've read now 6 books out of 7-book series. I might as well, but I just can't be bothered, you know? And that's what I felt like if me starting that second book, people have said, hey, you know what? It's not going to, what you get now out of the second book, you're just going to get more of out of the third book. Do you want more of that? I'd have been like, you know what?
Yeah, but
not
it has
really.
The answers and stuff no, at but, the end.
Yes, I know, but I guess if you just read the whole thing, but the second book and the third book are so different in tone from the first book that you've... And the tone is good in the second book. Like, I enjoyed parts of that, you know.
Sure.
The parts of that story and the grim tone. It's not as if I don't like stories which are grim. You know, Peter Watts is like one of my favourite authors. You're not gonna...
You don't get
that more grim and nihilistic and other things, you know. And it's totally fine. But yeah, it's just there has to be kind of more foundation behind it.
Yeah.
And I understand. Again, this isn't even getting into the themes of the book, because I think the themes of the book are really strong about, you know, about the attitude towards black people, you know, like the experience of being a minority in America with, you know, and I get a lot of that out of the book, but the first book kind of covered that for me in a way which was really great. You know, like I must have talked about it in the previous books, but like I really like the idea of... Or it's the same with the X-Men, you know, in the X-Men series, it's always like, oh, these people are really powerful and they can kill everyone and they're a minority, so they have to be persecuted, and we have to keep them in line and they have to go into ghettos and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like giving a realistic reason for what real life prejudice would be. Like cops, white American cops look at young black kids, 14-year-old black kids, and see scary thugs who are going to be able to just beat them up and kill them, you know.
Sure.
They can't. That doesn't exist in the real world, but what would it be like if there was a minority who could literally destroy a whole village just by getting into a bad mood?
Yeah.
You know, there is that kind of idea there, and what it would be like to be persecuted in that way, and what you would want to do to destroy the system. So it's a way of like, realisticising what the prejudices against black people in America are by white powerful people, like policemen or whatever, who have the power of life and death over young black kids. It's kind of, I don't know, realisticising them. It's sort of like taking what they think and actually saying, what if that was true?
Yeah.
And these people had the power not to fight back, but what would still keep them persecuted in that way? Even if the reason for their persecution was correct and real. Well, not correct, but it was based in reality. Like, these people can actually destroy
shake,
a village.
Shake yes. the whole ground.
Shake the whole ground, can wipe people out. You know, so there's lots of thematic exploration in that, but I didn't feel any more of that in this third book. Mm. I did feel it even more in the second book, because there's interesting stuff going on there. But this third book, even the major themes which were propelling me through the first two books in the series, here, I didn't even get that, because I felt it had been played out before. Like,
sure.
I say, the stuff that was going on about, oh, slavery is bad, and I'm like, yeah, I kind of picked up on that before with the, you know, not just in this book, but also in other books, you know, in the series, and it's, oh, it's bad to treat people badly, and I'm like, Yeah, I'm kind of picked that up all the way through this. It just didn't feel like there was anything like a new way of exploring this.
Yeah.
Especially not in this third book.
Well, it's tricky.
It is tricky. Anyway, I think I've talked long enough about this book now.
Okay.
Have you any other questions?
Not really. Should I get into it?
No, I think if you read the first, again, just depends what kind of thing. I don't think it's worth.
I think I'm personally not like the kind of grim fantasy science fiction person, so I kind of see that this is not really anything for me to push through.
No.
You know, like with the Nine Fox Gambit, where I then just decided, because it was my only book I had with me, to just push through. It was okay.
No, it was the second book in the series that you pushed through.
Oh, yeah, so, yeah. It was the... what's the second?
Raven Strategy.
Yeah. The Raven. And I don't like strategy things. I don't like politics. And it's still pushed through. But if it gets too dark and shit, and I just...
You mean you don't like political machinations in novels and stuff? Yeah, I know what you mean. Okay, so I would suggest for you... The first book is a perfectly good standalone novel.
And I read it, but
it's got a fun mystery. Ooh, what's the backstory here? And where is it going to go in the future? You know what? The future, not that fun to read about. And the backstory, not that satisfying when you actually get the full answers to it. And you get the full answers to it literally 28 hours later, audiobook-wise. Or at least 20 hours later. You actually get this. You actually get the deep backstory. There's other backstory and other answers. You know why Alabaster was doing what he did, but then like all the way back to the full history of the Stone Eaters and all that kind of stuff. It's, to be honest, I didn't think I needed to know who the Stone Eaters are, or where they came from. For me, they were just a fun fantasy race. You know, it's sort of like nobody says, "Okay, elves, where do they come from?" Well, actually. In Tolkien, yes, it is a lot about where the elves and the dwarves and stuff, the whole Silmarillion is there to explain all that. But you know what? You don't need to know that to enjoy The Hobbit. Like, The Hobbit is here are hobbits. They live underground. Here are dwarves. Yeah. They like gold and want to get this dragon.
Yeah.
Here are some elves. Here are some trolls. Here are some orcs. And they're just like, they're just in the world. And for me, Stone Eaters were kind of that. Really cool. Like, oh, this is a whole world about stone and magic and stuff. And there's some people who are Stone Eaters who are just there. I kind of just want to read the first book again just to remind myself how much I enjoyed not knowing where the Stone Eaters came from and not really knowing who the Guardian were, and not knowing. It's actually more fun not to have the deep backstory. It would have been more fun, but it was kind of written into a corner when they actually had to have a motivation of like, so why did Alabaster set this rift off and start destroying the world, and where's the moon coming about, what's that about? And it felt like N.K. Jemisin had kind of written herself into a corner to say, oh, now the next two books have to be about those kind of things. Sure. And I think it would have been a lot more fun if the next two books were just like, oh, here's some people, and they just have to survive in the post-apocalypse, and some of them are magic, and there's some stone eaters, and there's some dragons.
It would be a fun idea to just have, you have the first book, you set up a world, you set up people who destroy the world, and then... In the next book, you have...
Just a totally different set of characters.
You set totally different people who have nothing to do with the others. Yeah. Have their own adventure in that time, in that same environment, where they have to battle it in their own way.
It felt a bit sort of like with the Culture series, going, okay, the first book in our reading series, okay, the first book is Player of Games. So we're going to read the Player of Games. And then the second book is like, oh, and here's what... here's what Gerge did afterwards, and this is what happened to the empire out in the out in the Magellanic Clouds, and this is what they did. That's what happened afterwards out there, and this is what his drone went and did afterwards. I know. Here's the backstory of the ship who picked him up, and I'm just like, no, you know what? I'm kind of done with those characters. Let's stay in the culture and have another book. And they're like, okay, here's use of weapons, and you're like, that's it. Like, tell a story. Like, do storytelling, which is just as interesting. Can be in the same world, with the same magic, with even in the same, like, what's the fallout of this later?
Yeah, it can be in the same problems that the other people had, just not the same people.
Yeah, I didn't feel like I needed the full backstory of all these world and the characters. Okay, I think that's it. I'm going to give this book 2 stars, and overall, again, read the first book in the series. It is really good, but just know that it changes, and just there's been obviously a massive critical outpouring of love, and readers love this book, but just know that there might be some people out there who just... I just wasn't won over by books 2 and 3.
Happens.
And I could have been. But she didn't stick the landing. It's such an amazing opening run and somersault and flying through the air. And I'm just like, if you'd have just dived into a pool, that would have been great. But she tried to do a really complicated, you know, 1 foot landing and just fell over. It just didn't hit it for me. There's my gymnastics metaphor.
That's about it.
Or is that a gymnastics metaphor? Is sticking the landing? Is that, oh, you did, you flew?
No idea.
Maybe sticking the landing is okay. You flew all the way across the Atlantic Ocean in a plane with a single seat and a single engine. You got all the way across and you were coming into land and then
you ran out of fuel
and all you needed to do was bring it down and land it, and then you flipped the plane over and it ended up on fire and you on a parachute.
But that's a fun.
Didn't stick the landing.
Interesting.
We'll have to.
Maybe not fun. Interesting.
Message me on Twitter to tell me if I'm right about sticking the landing. Is it a gymnastics metaphor, or is it an aircraft metaphor, or is it something which I haven't even got?
Invented that.
I'm Luke Burridge, at Luke Burridge on Twitter. Juliana's on Twitter as well, JUKU Berlin. Juliana Kunzendorf Berlin, JUKU Berlin.
I sometimes tweet.
Yes, you do.
Very rarely, but nice.
And sometimes you're tagged in other tweets if you're on other podcasts and things like that, which is cool. Follow me on Instagram. I'm Luke Burridge there. Follow me on. Check out my stuff on YouTube. I'm posting juggling stuff there, and Juliana is joining in with those videos often.
Sometimes.
You're a really good camera operator.
Next up is the Berlin Juggling Convention. Berlin.
Yeah, there's some great stuff there. I'm Luke Burridge on YouTube. Check out lukeburridge.com/blog and see stuff there, I guess. No, what am I trying to say? sfbfp.com, and check out the episode list and the archive feed and all the cool stuff that you can find there. Recommend books to me on Goodreads. Become a Goodreads SFBRP listeners group, Goodreads member, it's not a fan, it's a listener group, it's not a fan thing. I don't like fans. I have listeners and friends on Goodreads. I don't have fans on Goodreads. I don't think I could cope with having fans. I think that's it. Goodreads, cool. Recommend me books in the books I would like to see reviewed. Next book that I'm reading is actually another book in a series, which is called Seven Surrenders, which is the second book in another one that was a series, which was Hugo or Nebula nominated, which is by my phone is so slow, and maybe I need to get a new iPhone. What do you think? My iPhone 6 is a little bit long in the tooth now. Seven Surrenders by Ada Palmer, which is I'm very much enjoying, and that is, oh my god, a crazy book. And what they've done is, because it's not so much first book in the trilogy, pause, second book, and it's sort of like the first book ends, and it's sort of like, and now the second book picks up literally minutes after the first book with the same author doing the same thing, and nice. It's sort of like, oh great, it's just more of the same, and I really enjoyed that, so let's go. So that's good. I'm enjoying that one.
I started reading a new book too. Just now.
What is the book?
China Mieville. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Perdido...
Perdido Street Station.
Street Station.
Yeah, let's have a look.
So I got some not recommendation, but people say that, it's a good book. So I'm...
Again, that is a book which the first half of that book I thought was, this is going to be one of my favourite books of all time. Again, for me, didn't stick the landing, which is a real pity.
Boo. Dead was. I saw it somewhere.
Yeah, it was a kind of an early book. Well, I can just type Perdido Street. Back on episode number 34.
Ooh.
Check that out. Back in 2008, I gave it 2.5 stars because the first half of that book is like a 4.5 star book. And the second half of that book is like a 1.5 star book. Let me tell you this. You can come back and fill us in on a later podcast.
Yeah.
If you ever get to a section of a book where you're like, he's described this city a lot before.
Yeah.
And all it is a describing parts of the city. Just skip forward until there's some action or dialogue or something.
Okay.
Because there's so many really long explanations. He really enjoys the city.
Baslag. The language.
It's fun at the start. But just believe me, when you get about a third of the way into the book, and you're like, he's just describing in minute detail another street or another neighbourhood, just read the first bit of the paragraph and then just skip forward until there's like action or dialogue, and you can really cut down
It feels a bit like, there's a German author, Thomas Mann, Heinrich and Thomas Mann, and they are... Like, they were known for big books with, like, describing interior, like, such detail. Like, they describe a cushion chair.
Yeah. I spent 3 pages on it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, at least. This reminds me a little bit of that. But I'm currently still enjoying the description of the very messy, stinky, smelly town.
Yes, but it just keeps going. He just has a thesaurus in front of him, and he just goes through every word. It's like, okay, synonyms for stinky.
Smell.
Stinky. Smelly, stinky, effluent, just carries on. And now this is broken down. Okay, how many different ways can I say broken, damage, smash, like this? Oh, and then they go to this thing. And there's a section, and I thought, okay, this is all we had a lot. And then there's another thing. Right near the end of the book, there's this thing. They need to put a bit of wire through the city. And it's sort of like, and then they ran the wire across this balcony and it looked like this, and then across this street, and then they put it across the top of this building, and then down this through, and then the wire went down here, and he's just scratching it. I was like, I've just spent the whole book listening or reading descriptions of this, and then at the end of the book he's like, now we're going to put a wire, and he then describes the route
all
of the wire
back.
All the way through, and I was just like, oh, you're just describing it more. And then at the end, oh, they're sailing away, and then they went down the river, and
don't
then they went out the
spoil
and
it.
Then the river,
I'm
and then they went past
it.
This neighborhood, and then at the very end of the book they say some of the characters sail away on the river, and then they're like, oh, and then they went through the nice suburbs pass, and it was really nice. And I'm like, oh, this whole book was this crummy, disgusting, smelly, broken down
you should have remembered a few more of the synonyms.
Yeah, I don't know, it's like describing squalor thesaurus, like deep dive into thesaurus.com. Anyway,
yeah.
Starts off really good. Starts off really good.
Okay. No, that's not my next project. Mainly.
Oh, and also you finished David Brin's the Nebula Hugo Nebula Award.
Yeah,
Brightness Reef. No, not Brightness Reef. What's the second book?
The Star Tide Rising.
Star Tide Rising.
That's what I finished. I really enjoyed it. It is an interesting read, and it feels more like it doesn't feel... I mean, of course, there are like lots of science fiction things happening. But it's on a ship that's stranded, and then they kind of have to get out of that situation. It's kind of like a...
It's a shipwreck.
It's a shipwreck story.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
And I always find it funny if people put... Like certain stories, like war movies or
just into a science fiction
frame. And then again, it doesn't feel like science fiction.
Yeah, but again, that's what this book I thought it was doing. Okay, now we're going to have the Napoleon army going into Russia and trying to get back out, and 90% of the people in the army dying, and only a few people.
But it wasn't that.
And I was like, oh, but I really enjoy that story. Like that same story being told in different science fiction and fantasy settings is a thing. Like the same way, like, oh, shipwrecked. Now we've got to repair the ship and put it back. Yeah. There's lots of these forms in science fiction. One of the classic ones is like, oh, we've got to get into space, or like there's a problem in space, a bit like The Martian. Okay, right, we've got to put together current space technology in such a way, we're going to like link it together, put it all together in such a way that we're going to save this person, or like Stephen Baxter did this kind of thing. Oh, we've got to get to the moon. Well, how do we get to the moon with current day technology and we don't have moon rockets anymore? Okay, well, there's actually a moon rocket in Alabama, and there's another one at the Kennedy Space Center, but these were Saturn V, which never flew, so let's get the engines from there and the bit from there. It's a certain thing, like it's not as much.
It's like a MacGyver story with space.
It's with space, and it's like a standard. And again, a shipwreck story. It was like, okay, I'm doing this. Alistair Reynolds does this quite often. He's like, okay, I'm now going to do a noir detective story. Yeah. I'm going to do a police procedural story. Yeah, and you're like, this is set in the... it's actually his next book, follow-up to The Prefect, and we both really enjoyed The Prefect. So I'm looking forward to that one. Hopefully Alistair Reynolds back on form after some not-so-amazing books. Anyway...
Yeah, I will see.
We've not been talking about the book for a while, but it's fun to have you on the podcast.
Thanks.
Okay. I've even said what the rating is, so we can just say goodbye, and that's it.
Let's say goodbye to people.
Catch you next time.
Goodbye.